My name is Jackie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jackie.
Good evening. First of all, I'd like to give thanks and praise to my higher power, which I choose to call God, for this privilege to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope with my AA family and friends. I was born in Marietta, Georgia, November 4th, 1960. I have two siblings. I have a younger sister and a younger brother. Both my parents were high school sweethearts. They're both from the Cobb County area. I'm going to jump right into the goody of it. Alcoholism and alcohol has been in my family for generations. It was nothing new. I'll give you a bit of history that there's a thing that was around for maybe 60 years around Cobb County, because Cobb County was a dry county up until 1974. So most people don't know that. So they had to have alcohol in some way. So they had to go through moonshiners or they had to make their own. And we had places in my neighborhood they call shot houses. And my family was a part of all these things they call shot houses. This is where you can go to get your alcohol, your vice, or whatever you wanted to get. Because it was like having a little convenience store in the neighborhood. There weren't very many places for blacks to go in Cobb County. So the other way, only way to get alcohol was through these shot houses. Now, I was directly involved because it was my aunts and my grandmother. And so when I was babysat as a toddler, I was over there all the time. And, you know, smoke-filled rooms, the loud laughter, the joke-telling, all that good stuff. So it wasn't unusual, it wasn't taboo to have someone walk up to me and put me in their arms and give me a sip of alcohol or moonshine or even take a drag off of a cigarette. I mean, it was just wasn't looked down upon. You do that today, you go to jail. So I got a taste of alcohol very early in life. Also, my parents were doing the same thing. They were selling alcohol in the basement of our house. They had it set up. They had a bar set up, a pool table, a few other things. So they were trying to make money on the side too. And my neighborhood was filled with kids. So we had people from all walks of life. We had Lockheed workers. We had school teachers, postal workers, so forth. They were all in and out of my parents' house drinking alcohol. And I can really recall as a kid circling around my dad's bar, and there wouldn't be no alcohol around, but I could smell it. It was like a little puppy. You know, I knew it was there, but I couldn't find where it was, you know. I was so curious. And growing up in my neighborhood, it was full of kids, you know, from all ages. You had, you know, high schoolers, college kids, but I was small for my age, and I got picked on. I got picked on a lot. I got picked on because I went to a private school. I went to a Catholic school, so I wore a tie, a sweater, you know, the nice little clean-cut clothes. I spoke properly, and the kids in my neighborhood took advantage of that. They would take my tie, they would hide it, they would put it in the trees. I'd chase them around. I'd go to my mom. My mom said, go get your from them. And they would also poke fun at me about other different issues. I had a learning disorder. And back then, it wasn't properly diagnosed. I'm sure it was ADD. Oh, shiny. So some of the kids knew that I had problems in school, and they would poke fun at that. And that gave me a sense that I really didn't fit in at all. And my parents, they did the best they could with what was available to them. I think they did a dynamite job. I love my parents dearly. But their marriage was toxic, and there was a lot of whispering, a lot of secrets. In between their drinking and their fights were verbal and physical, and it took its toll on me. It was some nights where you'd be up, I don't know, 3-4 hours listening to the chaos, and then it would die down. I don't know if I'm gonna get killed or what, but it would just die down. It got to the point where I hated to come home sometimes because the atmosphere was just so toxic. I never really heard my parents exchange any kind of pleasantries, except, I mean, I never heard them say, I love you, I miss you, where you've been, or something like that. I never seen my parents kiss or hug. So that gave me a sense of isolation. So as I grew older, I couldn't understand why I was always shunned and pushed aside. My first real experience with noticing the drink was probably when I was probably 8 or 9. I discovered the liquor cabinet. And I go into the liquor cabinet, I pull out the bottle with the little bat on it. It's the Bacardi, and that was my first real hit of Bacardi. And I think I ran wild for that whole day, but that was my first real taste of alcohol. As years went on, I entered high school. Now, high school was a totally different dimension for me. I grew up in a Catholic school, which had a lot of discipline, a lot of structure. So when I go to a public school, I see all this chaos. And I found myself in the same position where I didn't fit in at all. I would try to have a conversation with this set of kids and get laughed and pushed off, and this set of kids and get laughed and pushed off. So finally I found a group of kids who I could relate to. And those are the kids who were drinking the Boone's Farm in the woods and smoking cigarettes and drinking MD 2020 and sleeping in class. Those became my friends. So if any of you can realize what's going to happen next, my grades spiraled out of control. My mom took a real interest in this. She was pissed off all the time about that. I need to also say that as a child, trying to learn was real difficult for me. And I remember my mom was just so intense trying to get me to learn that she used a lot of corporal punishment, if you know what I mean, to get me to absorb the information, and it just wasn't happening. It just wasn't happening. They tried all kinds of things to get me into a better environment of learning. Sometimes it didn't work. Sometimes it became very toxic. I can remember being the center of laughter at the school I attended. They would point out different defects that I had at the time, and it would just crucify me. But finally, I guess about my sophomore year in high school, my mom had a friend in the athletic department who pulled me into the varsity program. I started playing varsity sports. Played varsity football, varsity basketball, varsity baseball. I was a halfback. I was a middle infielder. Had a lot of success. I got a lot of awards, some write-ups in the paper. I still didn't do that well in school, even though varsity sports kept me out of the alcohol and all the other drugs around. After graduation, I don't know if I graduated or they just said leave. But after graduation, a lot of my friends were getting scholarships, and they were getting full rides playing football and baseball. And Jackie was not getting any of those calls, and I couldn't figure out why. Well, it was made clear to me later on it was because of my grades. It was because I didn't apply myself. I spent more time doing everything else instead of applying myself to grades. So I wanted to play more football. I had made up my mind I wanted to play more football. And drinking wasn't a big deal then. I mean, I could take it or leave it then. So someone suggested to my family that I go to a community college, which I did. And I was able to earn credits enough to enter a historically black college in Atlanta called Morris Brown College. I walked on. I got instant success. God gave me a gift, and I used it. And I got a full scholarship, football scholarship. And the party began. The womanizing began. I used alcohol in every way I could. I used alcohol to drink with instructors. I used alcohol to lure women into my dormitory to have my way with them. This is something I'm not proud of, but it is part of my story. Women were objects to me. And for that, I think it just relates back to my childhood. I think I just wanted love so bad that I was willing to do anything, no matter what the shame was. And that's the point I got to. Academically, I did a whole lot better. It was something about the college atmosphere that I was able to apply myself. I wanted this. And football was secondary to me, even though I was doing really well in football. And my senior year, my coach approached me and told me that, you know, you're being scouted by a couple of NFL scouts. And I was like, yeah, right, whatever. You know, I'm 5 foot nothing, 100 and nothing pounds, and, you know, he's scouting me. But it was true. Ended up signing a free agent contract with the Seattle Seahawks. And what a joy that was. It really was. The NFL experience is something that you just can't relate to another person. It's dynamic. It's huge. It's colossal. I'll never forget it. There was a lot of drinking. I learned a new way of doing shots. I learned a new way of drinking before a game and after games. And alcohol was limitless. There was times when you would come in for practice, especially on Fridays, there would be a line of coolers as you walked into the locker room. And you just throw a couple of beers in your headgear and keep on walking. And, you know, it wasn't looked down on or anything else. It was just part of what we did. Well, I got released a little late into the preseason, really about this time of year I got released. This was in 1985, by the way. So I spent the next year staying in shape, staying in touch with my agent, and I wasn't drinking. I wasn't drinking at all, hardly. I was trying to really stay focused on, you know, getting back in the league, but it didn't happen. My mom said, get a job, so I had to get a job. I got a job working full-time at this big hotel. And initially, I started out in loss prevention, which is security. And after about a year or so, they promoted me to a management training program. And after that program, they put me into food and beverage. And if any of you know about food and beverage, you know, beverage is the real big money thing in there, and that's alcohol. And as clients came in and out, I got to experience all the receptions, the kickbacks, all those things. As a matter of fact, I had bottles in my office that I would display, but shortly thereafter, the bottles started to disappear because I was starting to drink them more than anything. There was a couple of times I was asked to go home or get a room while I was at work because the job was really starting to wear on me, and alcohol was my only out. Alcohol started to become my crutch at that time. If any time I had an issue with a client or with my boss, that was the first thing I would do is I'd go get drunk or I'd start drinking. Excuse me, and I thought that would ease what was going on for her, make it easier for me. So some days it was sometimes I couldn't even start my day without a shot. And that was almost a ritual. It was like walk in my office, pick up my report, flip over a couple of times, pour a shot, I'm off to the races. This was a daily routine for me. After a little while, maybe a year or so, I started to see the writing on the wall. They were trying to get rid of me, and it was pretty obvious. My drinking had gotten in the way of my career expansion. I was doing well, but every time they would have a meeting, I wasn't present because I was too drunk to be there, so I would send my assistant. And I guess my assistant got to thinking, look, you know, I'm doing his job. I may as well take over his job. So I got a little undermined. But my drinking was the key. So I ventured out and I started looking for a job before I got fired because I knew the firing was coming. And luckily for me, I landed a job working for UPS. I became a seasonal driver. I resigned from this hotel. I became a seasonal driver. This was in 1989. Get a little timeline going here. When I started working for them around September, I already got my 30-day seniority in. I wasn't drinking that much. I really tapered off. But after Christmas, they brought me back full time. And my father and I just had a real big blowout. It wasn't fisticuffs, but it was a bad blowout. And I was living at home at the time. So I had to move out, find my own place. And so once I did that, I established myself with a big bar. My girlfriend came over all the time, and all we did was drink, get up in the morning with hangovers, and slide to work. And this became a daily routine for the next couple of years. This is what we did. And we went, our favorite watering hole was a place called Fat Tuesdays. I don't know if any of you remember that place, where they did the frozen drinks. And we would mix and match all these frozen drinks just to get all these different colors. I'd be sick as hell the next day. Couldn't figure out what the hell just happened. How many times did I go in there and mix the 190 with this and this and that? And I said, ooh, this is so damn good. And be blind at the end of the night. You know, just couldn't figure that one out. She was my drinking buddy. And a few years into that, we decided to get married. Now, I've been with UPS now about 3 years. I'd really established myself as a driver. I wasn't drinking that much before I went to work, or after work either. But the wheels started to wobble when I got married. I started drinking before I came home. Before I came home, I had to stop and get me something before I got home. It was just, it gotten to be too much for me with the job, my new marriage. I had no skills. I had no real coping skills except alcohol. That was it. That was my only outlet. And my wife at the time, she never objected at all. As a matter of fact, if I brought her something, that was even the better. So there was no objection at all. A couple years later, my son came along. My oldest son came along, which is a real joy. We had a lot of events to go to then, a lot of family reunions, Christmas. If any of you know you got in-laws, you had to go to this house, that house, this house, and it's an all-day affair. Well, it's an all-day drinking for me, too. And usually by the end of the day, I'm so shit-faced, she has to pour me in the car or sleep. I have to sleep overnight. And this happened a number of times. We go to family or friends' homes, or we go to a sporting event. I was due to pass out and be poured into the car and taken home. Usually while I'm going home, I'd hear these words, "You ruin everything every time. You're always drunk. Why don't you stop?" And I just couldn't. I didn't know how. I have to tell this part because it's part of my story too. I started indulging in a lot of cocaine. It was the buffer zone for me. I could get to a point where I wouldn't pass out now. But it all started to really creep in. Right, I guess about four, my kid was about 4 years old, it all started to come to a head. I was starting to have an extramarital affair. I was cheating on my wife with a young lady who was using and boozing with me. We'd both decided, we had this young lady and I decided, had a premonition that we were going to start doing better, right? We're having an affair. How in the hell am I going to do better? But anyway, this was my thinking. My thinking was, yeah, we're going to join the gym. We're going to start eating better. We're going to start taking better care of ourselves, blah, blah, blah. And that's exactly what we started to do. And I cut back on the drinking. Sometimes I didn't drink for weeks. For weeks, more concentrating on the gym and drinking protein shakes and eating healthier and all that kind of thing. At the same time, I'm cheating on my wife. I mean, how much? What's wrong with this picture? So something gave me the wise idea, you know, that, you know, I'm tired of coming home to this woman and, you know, I could do better by myself. I could do better with this young lady. So I got my assets together and filed for divorce. I left my wife. Moved into an apartment. Put together me this big bar, of course, because that's the center of my life right now. And the young lady went this way and I went this way. So back to loneliness, and I haven't been that lonely in a very long time, and the only friend I had was alcohol. And like I said, I was using cocaine again, and I had a lot of connections with cocaine, and it was an every week, every day staple for me with the alcohol. The wheels were starting to really come off. One was popping off after the other. I met another young lady who's the mother of my youngest child, and she noticed that I had a problem and that it needed to be addressed. And after a few months of nagging, I gave in and I said, yeah, okay, I'll go get this fucking assessment, whatever. So I got up on a Saturday and I went to Ridgeview and I got this assessment. I went in and told them everything that I didn't want them to know, because I was going to protect my best friend, alcohol. And I went in there and walked out, and they said, "You don't have a problem, Mr. Scott." I said, "Yeah, I knew that." got my car and flipped my phone up and called her, just rubbing it in her face. You know, look, they said, I don't have a problem with alcohol and drugs. I'm fine. And her response was, really? I said, yes. I said, I'm good to go. By that time, I wrapped up the conversation. Well, I got to go now, as I was turning into a liquor store. And this is 10:30, 11 in the morning. I went straight in that liquor store, got my stash, whatever I got, and drove home. Well, on the way home, she called me back, and she said, remember now, we have a show we're going to tonight. I said, no problem, I got this, no problem. Well, that evening, she had almost beat my sliding door down because I had passed out from drinking so much that whole day. That was my MO on weekends. I drank till I passed out. Then I woke up, and I may have eaten something. And then I started to drink again. I said, well, this time I'm not going to get drunk. I'm just going to drink just enough to watch this program. Well, the program ended up watching me because I was out in no time flat. I was out. Well, shortly thereafter, she got tired of my lies and my I'm going to do's and I need to do and so forth. So we broke up. Within a couple of weeks, she called me. I said, she's called me back. So I think it's good. She wanted to talk. So I think we went out to lunch that day. And we met for lunch. And as we were talking, she let me know that we're pregnant. I said, damn. She was pregnant with my youngest son. And eventually the wheels started rolling up here. My thinking kicked in, which is not a good thing, the itty-bitty, shitty committee. And we decided we were going to buy us a new house for Jackie, because a new house is going to solve all my problems. A new house is going to put me in a different atmosphere. It's going to give me a different crowd to hang around. It's going to take care of all my woes. Well, it was the beginning of the worst of my woes. I got this house. Single family dwelling, whatever it was, really nice. Set the bar up, of course, and started having some parties. One party in particular I had, the cops came to the door, knocked on the door, and says, is this your house? I said, yes, sir. He says, how long y'all gonna be here? I said, well, a couple more hours. He says, I'll be back when my shift's over. So even the cops got involved, and they were coming to my place. One morning after one of these parties, and one of these really drunk fests, I saw a set of shoes laying behind my couch, and I said, oh, God, somebody died in my house. And fortunately for me, the guy was still alive. He just had passed out and fell behind my couch. But I got him up, and we started back drinking, and we started using coke, and that was just the way I lived my life. And every day when I got off of work, I had a stash in my car or in my truck. On my console with those little mini vodka bottles. And I'd have 12, 20 of them in that little thing. And when I got off work, I could be running on fumes and I need to stop and get gas. But boy, I tell you what, I was pouncing those things down before I got home. And by the time I would get home, I would have to fix me a drink just as I walked in the door. And that drink would carry me to the shower. And as I got out of the shower, I was back with that glass in my hand, back to the bar again to fix another drink. And this is the way I drank for the next 4, maybe 5 months. It was constant. I was going through 2 half gallons of vodka a week. That's a lot of liquor. I kept it in my freezer thinking that was some kind of big deal, but it got to the point where I couldn't even brush my teeth in the morning without a shot of liquor. My son would visit me sometimes, and we couldn't even leave my place without me getting hammered. I'd have to drink 3 or 4 shots and then have a to-go cup. And this is 10 in the morning, and I'm taking my son to a baseball game or his baseball game. And this is the way I thought everybody lived. This was normal to me. I didn't think anything weird about it. I mean, consequences were there, but I couldn't feel anything. There was no sense of responsibility at all. I had no spiritual growth at all to think of. And raised Catholic with my Baptist mother and my Methodist father, and then us in the middle as Catholics, me and my 2 siblings, it was kind of tough to, you know, really differentiate what was God and what was this, and God's going to send you to hell if you do this, and, you know, if you don't do this, you're a sinner. I was really confused. So God was completely out of my life then. And right around New Year's of 2006, it was New Year's Eve. This is when the wheels came off, and it was the weekend. I was going to my favorite liquor store, and I walked in, and the owner, he knew me because I was buying 2 half-gallons a week, plus the little shots. And I walk in, he says, you know, you can buy a case of these half gallons and save $35. I was like, you bullshit. He was like, yeah, you could save $35 if you buy this case. I was like, yeah, so I swiped that card real quick, walked out of there with that case of vodka on a New Year's weekend. Oh, shit. Well, I drank myself into oblivion the first night. I woke up, I had shit and pissed all over myself. I slid my clothes off of me and threw them in the wash area. I don't know if I washed them or not, but I did. I think I threw up on myself too. At that time, I was really demoralized, humiliated. I was sick. I didn't know what to do next. The sun was shining, but I wanted to die. And I knew alcohol, I know you could die from alcohol poisoning. And well, that was what I was gonna do. And then I started to chug and drink and chug and drink, and I took a half gallon upstairs to my room with me. I'm watching TV, and I said, you know, I guess when it's all said and done, they'll just say I just died of, I drank too much. And that particular night, I think that was New Year's Eve, I really tried to take my life with alcohol. That's what I thought would take me on out of here. I did wake up the next morning and looked at the ceiling, and I figured, well, maybe I'm dead. I realized I had to pee, so I wasn't dead. But the hangover was to die for. I mean, the hangover, I should have been dead. And if you've ever been in a situation where you could not stop from drinking, where you're just praying to God, please, you know, I just don't want to drink, I just don't want to drink, and you're still pouring it down your throat. I had been in that stage for a few months, and it just got to the point where I had no avenue except I thought death was the only thing I had. That was the only recourse I had. So the next few days, I called in sick at UPS. I called in sick every day. Oh, and by the way, I have to mention this. As a driver, now I've been driving now 25 years. Early in my career, I've been behind the wheel, legally drunk, hundreds of times. I've had cocaine on me. I've had alcohol on me. I've had customers go, have you been drinking? And I said, no, man, that must be something that's spilt in the truck. I don't know what that is. So I am so lucky that I never got caught. I never got pulled over or any of those things. I'm just part of my everyday living at UPS when I was working at UPS. To get back to this New Year's thing, where I was calling in every day, I called in for the next 4 days, and all I did was stay drunk the whole time. This is my drunk-a-log, and I did. I stayed drunk from morning to night, and I staggered around that house playing music as loud as I could, and no one complained. I just thought, you know, no one cared anymore. So Friday, I decided to get myself together and go into work. And I showed up for work on a Friday morning. And as I looked in my truck, we call them package cars. I looked in my package car, and it was a disaster inside. I was like, I can't do this. I can't do it. And I stepped out of my truck, and I walked right into the union business agent. And I pulled him aside, I said, I need to talk to you. And he walked over to me, and he said, what's up, Jackie? And I said, man, he's like, have you been drinking? I was like, yeah, that's what I want to talk to you about. But anyway, to make a long story short, we went into the manager's office and explained. I told him, look, I have a problem with drugs and alcohol. I need help. So I'd already been instructed by a family member, look, they have to honor that if you go in there and tell them you have a problem, they have to get you help. So that was the only avenue I had, and that was January, I want to say 12th or 13th of 2007. Now, I actually checked into Ridgeview on January 16th of 2007. My sobriety date is January 17th, 2007. I don't want to confuse everybody, but when I did check into Ridgeview, I could tell you without a doubt, I thought my life was over. I thought all the fun was gone. I thought, what am I going to do now? They're going to euthanize me here? What? I didn't know. I really didn't know. After a couple of days, I went to my first AA meeting. And when they were reading the promises, I didn't know it was the promises back then, but when they said, I think not, I said, oh shit, I'm in a cult, man. This is not good. But I hung in there. And that next day, the next morning, we stand in line getting meds, if you've ever been in there and getting meds, and stand in line getting meds. And this lady started singing America the Beautiful. And it was eloquent, it was beautiful, it was professional. And I thought it was part of the program. I said, wow, this is pretty cool. Somebody singing a song early in the morning. So I'm nosy, I had to see this. So I walked around, and there's this lady standing there with a nightgown on, with a robe hanging off of her, one slipper on. And she's singing into the wall. And I'm telling you, this is beautiful. She's just a trained professional. I knew she was, but when I saw that, I went, oh my God. And they escorted her right away, and she was still singing, escorted her back into the psych ward. Well, shortly thereafter, I think I went right behind her, and I walked up to one of the ladies in charge, and I said, you know what? I really don't belong here. And she assured me that I was in the right place. So I did go directly into a halfway house program, which to me probably was saving grace for me, because I did need that extra oomph. I needed an extra whatever you want to call it. I needed that. I'm a slow learner. I needed that. That's where I met my first sponsor. My first sponsor took me through the steps immediately. I think I went through them in 6 days. And I have to tell you that I just did the steps the first time just to get them over with. And as I progressed, or as I stayed in the program, I got another sponsor, and I went through the steps again. And again, I went through the steps just to get through the steps. I didn't get through the steps like they instruct us in the book. Now, the big book is filled with instructions and warnings. And they warn us about all these things if you don't follow these simple directions. And it's laid out for us, but not me. No, I'm gonna be a little defiant. I'm gonna do it my way. I'm gonna skim a little bit. And I stayed sober. Went to meetings, kept going to meetings, stayed in touch with the sponsor, got a couple sponsees a couple of times. But recently, in the last several months, a very close friend of mine in the program, a very dear friend of mine in the program, and I were having lunch, and they pointed out to me the dark side of the period. And it was probably due to my spiritual growth, and also me bullshitting on my fourth and fifth step. And they made this clear to me. You could say they were taking my inventory, whatever. I call it tough love. And they asked me, when's the last time you spoke with your sponsor? I said, it's been a while. Well, how long is a while? Months. And I didn't feel good telling that. I didn't feel good at all. I felt like I was really letting myself down. But I immediately called a sponsor that I had from 6 years ago, who's my sponsor now. And I asked him for help. And he immediately jumped in. And I told him what the problem was, that I was showing a real dark side, if you will. And we immediately got into the steps, and I started in my step work 4 and 5. And this time, when I went in, I didn't move the garbage around. I've used this metaphor before. When you go into your fourth and fifth step, it's imperative that you get that shit out. Fifth step, get it out to somebody who can hear what you got to say, who can understand you. If it's a pastor, if it's your sponsor, they say your sponsor's choice, but get it out. Don't do Jackie's routine. Jackie's routine will get you dead. So what I did in my first initial times doing the steps with the fourth and fifth, I took my garbage and I moved it around. I put it on somebody else's step. I put it in somebody else's yard. I took a tarp and threw over my wreckage so nobody could see it, but I knew it was still there. And that stuff festered. It had been festering for generations. I mean, not generations, but decades anyway. So when it finally got to so bad that it felt like, you know, when you need to vomit, you get that nasty smell, I mean, that nasty taste in your mouth, you're like, I got to get this out. That's when I knew I had to get it all out. And once I started to write it down and put it on paper, everything started coming on like a Christmas tree for me. There was no more hiding. There was stuff I had to get out. It had to go. It was keeping me from the sunlight. It was keeping me from the light of the Spirit. It had taken everything. I needed to fill this hole with something I had. And I thought I was spiritually fit, but I was still lacking in some areas that I didn't get rid of. There were some things that had to go. In your fourth and fifth step, I'm telling you people, it is imperative that you get this stuff out. And once I did get it out, and I was able to share the information that I needed to get out, a couple days later, I had this colossal workout in the gym. And after the gym, I went home, I showered, and during the shower, I broke down and started crying. And it was one of those cries where I didn't know where it came from. I thought I was having a nervous breakdown. I didn't know what was going on with me. You know how a kid at the end of their cry, they're going like, they're hyperventilating, like, that's what was happening with me at the end of this cry. And I dried off and I said, well, maybe I'm having a stroke. I'm getting ready to stroke out and have a heart attack. I'm going to die. I fell asleep on my bed, and a couple hours later, I got up and I said, you know what? I feel pretty good. I'm going to go treat myself to my favorite steakhouse. And when I went to have my meal, the waitress came over to my table and said, the couple over there just paid for your meal. I was like, who the fuck paid for my So, and I looked at her and they waved at me. I didn't recognize them in the beginning, but it turned out they were one of my customers from over 20 years ago that I delivered to when I first started with UPS. And I walked over to them, we started a conversation, and I told them that I was an alcoholic, and drug addict, and I'm in recovery, and I'm this and that. And all of a sudden, a lady started to cry. And I was like, what did I say? Damn, again, Jackie? But her husband assured me it was okay. And as she stopped crying, she said their son had passed away 20 years ago from drugs and alcohol. And for me, I thought, well, man, I just carried the message, man. I just showed them or relayed something that was quite beautiful to them. And it was beautiful to me, too. Shortly thereafter, I had another one of those enlightening moments where I just started laughing out of control, where I was like, oh, man, this is a great way to live. I wouldn't trade it for nothing else. The things I've learned in these rooms, having the sponsor I have today, has really changed Jackie's life. Today, when I wake up in the morning, I give thanks and praise immediately because I know how easily I can go back. And I know how much pain I was in when I was there. I don't want to go through that pain anymore. I don't have to. I choose not to drink today. I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. And I mean that from my soul. And I've been in a lot of unhappy situations. But today, I'm happier than I've ever been. And it's all thanks to this program and the people in this room. The first 164 pages is the program. The people in this room, my friends, this is the fellowship. The cookies and all that kind of stuff, that's the fellowship. The meetings we do outside, that's the fellowship. But the first 164 gives us clear directions on what happened and what will happen. And also gives us promises. This is what I've learned. I used to look at the big book in black and white. Today I look at the big book in complete HD. I want to read this before I wrap this up. It's on page 276 of the big book. Now there's a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for the bottle and a hangover, we are given the keys of the kingdom. And for me, when I opened the book tonight, that's the first page I opened up to, and I was like, wow, this is perfect. This is the perfect way I think now, because I really feel great today. And as anybody in here struggling, there is hope. Well, you thought hope wasn't present. Hope is all around you today in this room. And I'm Jackie. I'm an alcoholic.